From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. It's Tech Tuesday. On Tech Tuesday today, airplanes and cell phones. Later in the broadcast, we look at the debate over lifting the federal ban on in-flight phone calls. But first, new revelations about a government spying program that mounts fake cell towers on small planes and grabs data from the phones of fugitives, drug dealers, and law-abiding Americans on the ground. The Wall Street Journal reports that the U.S. Marshals Service sends up planes equipped with a device that tricks cell phones below into identifying themselves. If the device finds the phone it's looking for, it can then home in and locate it with great precision. Joining us to explain this 7-year-old crime-fighting and privacy-challenging program is Devlin Barrett. He's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from studios at the Wall Street Journal's Washington's Bureau. Devlin, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Kojo.
If you have comments or questions, give us a call, 800-433-8850. You could send email to kojo@wamu.org. Devlin, you wrote about the secret program of the U.S. Marshals Service. It's part of the Justice Department. Program uses fake cell phone towers mounted on planes to try to locate criminals and fugitives. How do these fake cell phone towers communicate with cell phones below and ask them for their unique identifier?
Well, they basically use the existing cell phone technology and essentially trick these phones into identifying themselves. What they do is they send out a signal that says, okay, this device is the nearest cell tower. Now, as you probably know, all cell phones are designed to connect with the nearest tower. Otherwise, it would be very hard to make calls most of the time. Now, this device isn't really a tower, but it sends out just enough information to make the phones believe that it is the nearest tower, even though it's not the nearest tower. And then all the phones that can hear that device send in their registration information, which the device then sorts through looking for the special number that it's seeking.
The technology lets the Marshals Service make a broad sweep over an area and then zero in on the target phone by triangulating its location. How does that happen?
Right. Well, it's pretty interesting technology. And what they've done is they've taken a technology that we've known about and they've added a new twist, which is to make it airborne. And making it airborne makes it much more effective and much more powerful. Essentially, what the technology does is because it registers the identifying information from the phone, it can then say, okay, now that I have the phone that I'm looking for, I want to focus on that signal and I want to figure out where that signal is coming from. This usually means the plane will do sort of a long arc so that it will pick up the signal strength from a couple different locations in the sky, and then it can give you a reading within, 2 or 3 meters as to exactly where that phone is.
And so when I'm walking around with my cell phone, if this plane happens to be flying in the sky, it means that my cell phone, along with maybe thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of others who are in that general area, I guess depending on how inhabited the area is, all of our cell phones will tell this cell tower, here I am, here's my information.
Right.
Correct?
Now, correct.
The fake cell tower then analyzes or goes through that information. Mm-hmm. Who is the government looking for with this technology? It's being used both domestically and overseas.
Correct. Domestically, what they're doing is they're looking for largely fugitives, but also just criminals who are wanted and haven't been caught. So, everything from drug dealers to suspected murderers to folks that are, frankly, worth putting a plane up in the air to look for. What I'm told is that they rarely will go up looking for just one person as a function of like time and money, essentially. They'll often try and do 10 fugitives in a group, let's say, and search for all 10 of those numbers to justify the cost and expense of having the plane up and having people on the ground coordinating with them.
Do you know whether or not it has been successful?
I'm told it's very successful. For finding fugitives, I'm told this is a very effective method. And, some of the applications are obviously trickier overseas, because in overseas you're talking about war zones and things like that. But I'm told it's a very effective method, and the concerns that are raised, frankly, are concerns of what about all the innocent people's data that's being sort of filtered through this machine along the way.
That's what I was about to raise. Fine, I can say goodbye to my bookie, but this program raises civil liberties questions. One is, how well judges understand the technology when they okay this type of search? Another is, how much privacy is worth invading to find one, or as you point out, usually a few, criminal suspects?
Right, and that's the big question. One of the sort of great civil liberties questions that's been posed by this is, all right, so how many people's privacy is it worth invading to find one criminal? Is it worth invading 100 people's privacy? Is it worth invading, you know, thousands of people's privacy? And these are very small bites of data they're taking, and they're taking them for very short periods of time. I think what concerns the civil liberties folks is the fact that even though you're taking a very small small bite of data for a very short period of time, you know, multiply that by 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 per flight, and you've got a lot of information.
We're talking with Devlin Barrett. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal about his story on airplane-mounted devices that are spying on Americans, courtesy of the U.S. Marshals Service of the Justice Department. You can call us with your questions or concerns at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation, ask a question, or make a comment there. Devlin, how did the companies that provide cell phone service react to news of this program, which can momentarily hijack their customers' phone signal?
I'm told they had no idea. Verizon says that when we called them was the first they'd heard of it. And the FCC, which actually regulates the airwaves, also said they had no idea this was going on. So I think the folks who work in this space, you know, as commercial partners and regulatory agencies, really were in the dark about this. And it'll be interesting to see how they respond to the idea that, you know, look, the government is operating a device that basically pretends to be a Verizon tower, or pretends to be a Sprint tower, or pretends to be an AT&T tower. You know, over the long run, I don't know how the companies are going to feel about that.
800-433-8850. Do you feel it's appropriate for the government to be using this tactic in order to find fugitives and criminals? Or do you feel it might be an invasion of your privacy? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Devlin, do we know what happens to this phone identification data after it's collected? Is it saved for future reference? Is it immediately discarded?
The government says they don't keep a database of this information. We do know that the devices are built in such a way that the devices themselves can hold the information. So one of the questions I, as a reporter, have had is, you know, are people being careful to wipe these devices after every use? Or are the machines just sort of sitting on a bunch of data? And frankly, we don't have an answer on that at this point. The government does say they don't keep an overall database, but I think the sort of unanswered question at this point is, are there a lot of, frankly, little databases sitting out there?
Here is Juanita in Washington, D.C. Juanita, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Kojo, thanks for taking my call. My thing is, with the United States, and I've known this for a long time now, or watched it or listened to it, they tell everything that they do. How do you catch people with a device and you've already told them that you're trying to? Me, I don't care if they listen to my conversation because I'm not doing anything wrong. But it seems to me that they divulge so many secrets of how they're doing things to catch people, that the people are finding another way to, you know, do what they have to do so they can't get caught.
Well, there's a couple of aspects of that. This information was not voluntarily divulged. Devlin Barrett, tell us how you came up with this information.
Well, you know, I'm a reporter, so I go digging for stuff, and sometimes I find stuff. I mean, I think it's an interesting split that you see when you talk about surveillance issues in the general public, and I think people who trust the government tend to be essentially okay with it, and people who don't trust the government tend to not be okay with it, because with a lot of these programs, and I think this would be included in the broader category of surveillance programs, if they're being careful and they're being smart, it's probably okay. But I think a lot of people think, you know, once you create a program for a good reason, it can be used for a bad reason too. And I think that's the fear that a lot of people have, that this could be abused or misused at some point down the road.
And in the past, there have been newspaper and news media reports over centuries of similar of abuse taking place of such programs, so that I think those people who are skeptical about whether the government is always using this in their best interest do have some database, if you will, for their concerns.
Well, right, and everything's a human enterprise, right? There's, you know, it's a little hard to swallow the notion that no one's ever going to screw this up. So I think one of the questions that you always have to ask is, are judges monitoring this stuff carefully?
Correct.
Or are judges as in the dark as the general public is about exactly how this data is gathered and what's done with it?
On to Andre in La Plata, Maryland. Andre, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, guys. I have a question. Putting aside the privacy concerns, what happens if this is a fake tower? What happens when somebody is in real emergencies trying to place an emergency call?
That's a terrific question, and this was actually something that fascinated me when I figured it out, is that they were so concerned about that issue when they were developing this system that they actually created a sort of a little cutout so that anyone calling 911, their phone service won't be interrupted or messed with, which is telling to me because it suggests that there is some awareness that this is not a completely harmless activity in terms of phone service, that there is some degree of possible disruption for average people while they search the skies. But they did do a technical fix for that exact issue because they wanted to make sure that in the course of doing law enforcement work, they weren't also doing something that hurt law enforcement work.
Which raises a technology question that I know is puzzling for me, and that is the caller seems to suggest that if this is a fake cell tower and it tricks your phone into thinking it is a real cell tower, that your call is not necessarily going to the person or agency for whom it is intended.
Well, remember, it tricks the phones into thinking it's a fake cell tower, but this device can't actually place any calls for you. So what happens is, as for the split second, essentially, that you are, the phone is sending its data up to this device, it's essentially distracting your phone from doing the thing that the phone would normally be doing or should normally be doing. So for that split moment, you're sort of, you know, cut out to some degree. But then, assuming you're not the person they're looking for, the device lets go of your number, lets go of your information, and your phone goes back to looking for the regular cell towers.
Okay, thank you. Here is Salil in Arlington, Virginia. Salil, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you. I was curious just to see, you know, to me it seems like the devil is in the details. What is the shape of the data that the device is collecting? Is it just collecting IMEI numbers and sorting through them and phone numbers, or does it have, like, metadata that it's mapping to? You know, like, it seems like the invasion of privacy issue would be completely tied to that. If it's just a long registry of numbers, then it may be completely harmless. There's no way you can actually map it to a person.
Well, ultimately, Devlin, I guess the objective is to locate a person, but you can address the more technical aspects.
Right,
of that.
And that's a great question because it is just sucking up the registration number, that basic identifier of the phone. Now, it's absolutely right that is, you know, sort of the most basic and general information about the phone, but that still tells you a little something about the person behind it because, you know, it's not hard to pair up that identifier with other identifying information if you want to. And even though you're in a plane and even though you're casting a wide net here, it also tells you some general information data, right? Because, well, if you're over, you know, a Philadelphia suburb and you get a hit for a particular number, you know that number is somewhere below you. So it is absolutely correct that this is, you know, the most very basic identifying number for the phone. And with that, you get an inference of location. And if someone wanted to, they could use that to develop out more information. One of the makers of one of these products has marketed the devices, their device's ability to go back and cross-reference this information later and compare one sweep to another sweep. And so bit by bit, if you wanted to, you could develop out a lot more information. But the caller is right to suggest that, you know, you're talking about on the first pass, you know, a very basic piece of information and a very generalized piece of location.
Thank you very much for your call. We move on now to Michael in Reston, Virginia. Michael, your turn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick question. So why is it better for law enforcement to bypass what AT&T and Verizon should already have? I mean, shouldn't law enforcement be able to go to these carriers and say, tell us where this is today? Why do they need to bypass them to do that? Thank you.
Devlin?
Great question. And it's one of the most fascinating parts of this to me, which is the government has today the ability to go directly to the phone company and get this sort of information. There's a couple reasons why they like this method better. One, this technology is fairly sophisticated and actually can generate more precise location data on a person. So by that I mean sometimes when they go through the phone company, they will get a more blurry picture of where the phone is. The second reason is sort of the more practical one, which is, you know, you cut out the middleman. We decide today we are going up to search for this thing. We are not beholden to anyone else to go do this search. We are taking it upon ourselves to, you know, send essentially a decoy into the telecommunication system and figure it out ourselves. That's appealing to law enforcement in some ways as well. I think one of the odd parts of this is that the law has long been based on the notion that you can look for people's phone information because people already share that information with the phone company, so it's not private. But here they're doing something different. Here they're pretending to be the phone company and just taking the information.
Devlin Barrett, he's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Devlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was fun.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, it is Tech Tuesday. We'll be looking at the debate over lifting that federal ban on in-flight phone calls. You can start calling now, 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Namdi. Air travel isn't what it used to be. We're X-rayed on the way to the gate, packed into even cozier seats, and charged for food, bags, and extra legroom. But some travelers still relish a long flight because it's the one place they can stow their phones and read a good book in a quiet sanctuary 6 miles above the earth. Now that peaceful airline cabin could get a little less tranquil. Two government agencies are exploring the possibility of lifting a ban on cellular service on aircraft and permitting phone calls in flight. With the evolution of technology, the safety questions have all but disappeared. A dozen non-American airlines already allow voice calls, and some say it's time for U.S. airlines to do the same. But flight attendants and a lot of travelers say no way. Joining me to examine the technology in question and the arguments for and against in-flight phone calls is Julie Frederick. She's a government affairs representative for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants and an international flight attendant for American Airlines with over 30 years of flying experience. She joins us in studio. Julie Frederick, welcome.
Thank you.
Also in studio with us is Charles Leoka. Charlie is chairman and founder of Travelers United. Charles Leoka, good to see you again.
Glad to be here.
You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Joining us from studios at WLS in Chicago is Steve Nolan. He is director of communications for Gogo. Steve Nolan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie, a year ago, the Federal Aviation Administration removed a decades-old ban on using personal electronic devices on planes. How did the evolution of technology convince the FAA there was no longer any danger? And what are the rules on planes today?
Well, the big thing that happened is that they found ways to direct the cell phone emissions from planes so as not going out to hit many, many towers. Which used to, according to the FCC, it would disrupt cell phone coverage across the country when we were having this kind of non-directed cell phone traffic going. Once that happened, they've now tested everything. They've tried to find out whether or not it had any kind of effect on instrumentation in aircraft, and the manufacturers of the instruments now have to make sure that the instruments are designed so that they are not, there's no interference. And so because they've eliminated those kinds of safety problems, the FCC said, okay, cell phones can be used. And DOT has allowed the personal electronic devices to be used. However, they still haven't decided whether or not they're going to allow voice transmission, which is one part of the entire cell phone spectrum.
Julie Frederick, flight attendants didn't like being the traffic cops who had to tell passengers to turn off their devices. How has the change in policy changed your pre-takeoff routine?
Well, it was a relief, frankly, because flight attendants never want to be in the position of the enforcer. So as we went through the cabin and had to confirm that passengers' personal electronic devices were off, it became somewhat cumbersome. Our position now is that transformation to allow those devices to be used has been seamless. And during the critical phases of flight, which are takeoff, taxi, and landing, that those devices just need to be stowed appropriately as any other piece of carry-on baggage.
Steve, how did that FAA decision open the door for companies like yours to step in and provide Wi-Fi service on planes?
Well, we've been actually providing Wi-Fi for some time. I think it's important to make the distinction between the radio on your phone and the Wi-Fi service on your phone. So you still have to turn your phone into airplane mode when you get on a plane, but you've been able to obviously connect through Gogo Wi-Fi and others for quite some time. In fact, we launched the service in 2008. But I think, the issue now is whether or not the radio on your phone will be allowed at some point. And frankly, from our perspective, we've had a technology out there for a while that would allow passengers to make phone calls without the radio turned on through the Wi-Fi system. In fact, we deployed that in our business aviation group about a year ago. But we know that our airline partners do not want passengers to talk on cell phones. Consumers certainly don't seem to want it. So from that perspective, we're very much, aligned with our airline partners on that, if for some reason an airline wanted to do it, we could do it today. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
Let's ask our listeners, do you use your smartphone on the plane? What do you do on it? And I guess, more importantly for this conversation, should voice phone calls be allowed on planes during a flight? What do you think? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show using the hashtag TechTuesday. Or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Steve, how does in-flight Wi-Fi work, and what does it allow passengers to do?
Well, simply put, it allows you to access the Internet while you're in flight. We use a couple of different technologies to deliver it. For the most part in the United States, we have built our own network of cellular towers that actually broadcast a signal up to the plane. So as the plane's kind of flying across the continental United States, it's picking up a signal from towers. That's obviously good for a large contiguous landmass like the U.S., but outside the U.S., it's very difficult to do it that way. Obviously, planes traveling across an ocean aren't going to get technology to a plane that way. So we have a satellite service as well, and that is very much in use now for international service. But at its core, it really just allows passengers to access the Internet and the Internet only.
Charlie, now that Wi-Fi is functioning on planes, the next question is cellular service. You talked about the FCC ban on cellular service 20 years ago. That's changed. The ban was adopted in 1991. The technology has changed since then, no longer going to necessarily affect the plane's flight themselves. But if the FCC drops its ban on cellular service, the Department of Transportation could still say no to voice calls in flight. The department's Advisory Committee for Aviation Consumer Protections held a hearing on this issue last month. What has the DOT heard from consumers, and what authority does it have to act here?
Well, basically, I serve on that advisory committee, and what we've heard from consumers so far is a pretty loud and clear no, but even hell no. We don't want to have any voice calls on the phone. However, it's also, if we go and we look at what's happening where voice calls are allowed on planes in Europe, we find out that there's been no problems with air rage and no real complaints.
We'll hear a little bit more about that shortly, but go ahead.
And so we've got, this is something which is, it might be a problem right now. I think that a lot of people think it's going to be a big problem, but somehow I think that things in the end will be able to be figured out. And if it is a problem, the airlines have the capability of shutting off voice calls. And what I think we're looking at right now from a technology point of view is another system that you can use in order to use your cell phone. And that would be using your carrier plan instead of just using Wi-Fi. And so the Wi-Fi is already established with GoGo and some other service providers. And now the carrier plan, which is going to send, which would carry voice calls, would come in. And so it's not going to be that big a change. The big change is whether or not voice will be allowed or not allowed.
Joining us now by phone from London is Kevin Rogers. He is the CEO of AeroMobile. Kevin Rogers, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Kevin, AeroMobile provides cell phone calling on a dozen international airlines. How does AeroMobile's in-flight phone service work, and which airlines are some of your customers?
Well, the in-flight mobile phone connectivity, Gojo, works through an installed picocell. So you can't just get on an aircraft and switch your mobile phone on, of course. You have to use it on an aircraft which is equipped with a specialized system, just like a Wi-Fi-enabled aircraft. We're installed on around about 300 aircraft across the world, and some of the airline customers include Emirates, Lufthansa, Virgin Atlantic, Singapore Airlines, and Etihad.
What types of passengers use the service, and how do they use it to make calls and text messages?
Well, there's a couple of things here. It's worth bearing in mind that that most of these airline customers that we're dealing with have both Wi-Fi and this picocell or cellular connectivity installed on the aircraft. So we believe that when you're serving an aircraft cabin, you've got many different user preferences. So some people just choose to use their cellular phone just like they do on the ground, albeit as an international roaming service, and some people prefer to log on and use a longer Wi-Fi internet session. I think there's a frustrating association of the cell phone, particularly in the US, with voice. What we must bear in mind is that the most dominant service used on the cell phone is data and then text. So considerably less than 20% of the users of this connectivity use it for voice. Voice is not often used. And the other aspect to bear in mind very much is that some of the voice discussions that you have in the U.S., we also have in other parts of the world, but in those cases, it's the airline that just chooses to switch off voice and that's switched off by default. So Lufthansa, for example, is one of those airlines that doesn't operate the voice service.
Kevin, you testified at the Department of Transportation Committee here in Washington last month in favor of allowing voice calls on U.S. airlines. Do you feel that there is a demand for such calls on American flights?
Well, I'd just like to put a slight caveat on that. I think the message that I was trying to bring across was rather than regulate it, let the airline choose. Now, to be frank, I very much doubt that airlines in the U.S. will allow voice. The subject is far too emotive. But do what the rest of the world is doing and allow the airlines to make the choice. The regulators don't need to get involved.
Julie, you testified at the Department of Transportation Committee hearing against allowing phone calls on flights. Why?
Well, certainly flight attendants know the aircraft cabin, and we certainly know our passengers. And I think the comment period to both the FCC and the DOT were overwhelmingly, I think they received a combined nearly 3,000 comments, and 98% were against voice communications. We really just don't want to be in the position of having to regulate the aircraft. We've heard, you know, indications that perhaps an area of the airplane could be isolated for voice calls. We think that's a bad idea. But more importantly, we believe that the DOT does have the authority and the obligation to make a decision to prohibit voice calls. You know, part of the DOT's responsibility is to evaluate the protection of rights for the air traveler. And they've done so in the past, and we think they should do so in the future. More importantly, if Secretary Fox fails to do that, we are fully prepared to support legislation which has been introduced in both the House and the Senate to ban voice calls on board the aircraft.
On to the telephones. Here is Alicia in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Alicia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Alicia, you're breaking up. I'm going to put you back on hold, see if you can get to a more secure location while we talk with Andy in Arlington, Virginia. Andy, your turn.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for having me on, Kojo. Basically, I just want to make a comment as someone who flies a lot, there's so many logistical and technological devices put in place to have a personal experience, i.e. watching a movie in silence or experiencing media through headphones. If you have people talking on a plane, wouldn't there be a logistical issue and a noise issue for folks that maybe just want to not have to hear people around them making a lot of noise? There's so much noise in an airplane anyway. Why would there be a need for having everyone talking? Maybe it works in Europe. I can see that, but a lot of people like to talk in the U.S., and I just don't see it being a very enjoyable experience.
Julie Frederick.
Well, I think you make an excellent point, and in fact, that's what we hear from our customers. We know that people, when they talk on their cell phones, typically talk much louder. While I was traveling up on the airplane yesterday, the aircraft noise was significant, and so if I were to be speaking on my cell phone, it would be quite loud. In fact, our personal policy at my airline has a minimizing disturbance to customers. And so, in fact, the other day I had a personal experience where a young mother was traveling with her two small children, and she had a Disney video that she was showing to them, and it was being broadcast so the two little girls could hear it. And I had a problem with a passenger adjacent who was disturbed by that, and I had to ask that lady to insert headphones or turn it off so that her children could not watch the movie. And that was certainly disappointing, because we know that passengers' goal is to get from point A to point B as quickly and as comfortably as possible. And that was not the case in this situation.
Charlie Leoka.
I think the other thing we need to consider is that speaking on cell phones on planes is not going to be like it is talking on the ground. You just can't pick up your phone and talk for free. There used to be phones in the back of all the seat backs on airplanes, and people didn't use them. Why? It cost too much money. You thought if you even looked at it, they were going to charge you. And with cell phones, it'll be like roaming. We'll be back to roaming charges. So that's one thing which changes. And the other thing that changes is there are different types of passengers. Let's say looking at a transcontinental flight or a long flight, you might be able to, as it's been explained to me, allow cell phones for the first half an hour after you take off and for another half an hour before you're landing. But otherwise, it will be quiet time in between. And when you're talking to business travelers who fly between D.C. and New York or Boston and New York, they would like to use their cell phones because they're trying to maximize all of their time. And that's a short flight, which never has a movie. So it becomes... There's a lot of different factors that go into the type of passenger, and I think that part of where I think we need to go is to allow probably the airlines to control this on a flight-by-flight basis and make up their own minds, and we'll see where it goes. DOT is going to have to make a decision one way or the other.
Kevin Rogers, I have two questions for you. Based on your experience, what is your response to these concerns? And the second part of that question is that have you observed any cultural difference in the way people in different countries use voice calls on cell phones?
Okay, we're taking the first question first. My sincere recommendation is that let market forces apply here, because, again, looking at the airlines that we operate on, sort of 50%, half of those airlines do not operate voice by default. So the airline has taken a decision based on what it believes to be the requirements of its passengers. You can't use your voice service on those aircraft. And again, just to stress where voice is allowed, the number of calls are very small, and in the 6 years that we and our competition have been operating the service, we haven't had any issues with respect to issues in the cabin. So basically, let market forces apply, and I strongly believe that the U.S. airlines won't allow voice anyway, even if the DOT decides not to regulate it.
Is that because of a cultural difference in your view?
Well, I haven't got too much longer on this call to express all my views here. I'm not convinced there's a cultural difference. I think these questions have come up elsewhere in Europe. They've come up elsewhere in the world. But the regulators just step back and allow the airlines to make the decision. I wouldn't say there's a big cultural difference from my experiences. I think there's other factors at play in the States which are causing this debate to take place.
Kevin Rogers is the CEO of AeroMobil. He joined us by phone from London. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we continue this Tech Tuesday conversation on should the U.S. allow phone calls on planes. You can call us at 800-433-8850. What tech capabilities would you like to see on planes? Would you boycott an airline that allowed passengers to make phone calls in flight? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nand. Coming up at 1, outgoing D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray reportedly declined a plea deal with federal prosecutors, the latest in the ongoing investigation. Plus, former Washington Post editor Marcus Brauchle on the expanding role of technology in social change. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nand Show on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org. Welcome back to our Tech Tuesday conversation on whether or not the U.S. should allow phone calls on planes. We're talking with Charles Liocca. He is chairman and founder of Travelers United. Steve Nolan is director of communications from Gogo, who he joins us from studios at WLS in Chicago. And Julie Frederick is government affairs representative for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants and an international flight attendant for American Airlines with over 30 years of flying experience. We're inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Steve Nolan, I'm afraid we didn't get you in on the discussion about voice calls in the U.S. What is your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think our view is pretty simple. I mean, the market has really spoken on this. I mean, our airline partners clearly do not want it, and we've heard loud and clear from passengers that they don't want it. One service, though, that we do offer today is text messaging. And we basically work through T-Mobile that allows passengers who are a T-Mobile customer to text message for free in the air, just like they would from the ground. So the technology has existed for a while to do it, but we haven't, you know, really wanted to do it because like I said, the market has really spoken on this one.
Well, let's see how divided our listeners are on this issue. We got a post on our website from Dave who said, no way would I want to be on a plane load of flies yapping on their phone. An email from Scott who says, I do not want to be stuck next to someone yammering on their cell phone. Flying in an airplane is irritating enough as it is. Let them text, but it's noisy enough. Tweet from Nicole who says, airplane etiquette is bad enough these days. I can't imagine how insufferable flights would be with cell phone use. A tweet from Grace who says, I'm not interested in listening to other people's phone calls while trapped at 30,000 feet, and an email from George who says, traveling in a cramped cabin is already unpleasant enough. I can hardly imagine a greater nuisance than having to hear other passengers' phone conversations during a flight, other than perhaps the first and last 5 minutes of a flight. What do you think about that, Julie, the first and last 5 minutes?
Well, again, that's certainly a challenge in connectivity, and perhaps the technology people can speak to that more clearly. It's difficult to connect while you're too close to the ground. But again, it's an enforcement issue that puts flight attendants in the unenviable position of trying to regulate the cabin. We know that passenger misconduct incidences are on the rise. Certainly, it's because our cabins are more and more at capacity every day, and it's just not, we anticipate that should voice calls be permitted, that those passenger misconducts will rise. Certainly there was a recent incident with the knee defender. Personal space is an absolute issue for everybody, and the knee defender created a situation where an aircraft had to make an unscheduled landing as a result of a passenger misconduct because someone's space was invaded, and I think voice calls would certainly do the same thing. And more importantly, I was thinking regarding next gen, which is certainly something that we're looking at, particularly with the next FAA reauthorization bill. Our position is that the customer experience and the comfort of our passengers, for our business passengers in particular, that they do want to stay connected, and we believe that they're able to do so. In fact, very few people, I spoke to a recent graduate from UC Berkeley School of Information, and he said he uses very little voice communication anymore. He's on Wi-Fi and he's on text through his computer. So we don't think that it's putting our business passengers at a disadvantage because they can stay connected.
Charlie, your group conducted a survey on the question of allowing phone calls on planes. Allow me to ask you what now seems to be a completely redundant question. Who did you ask and what were the responses?
Well, we went out to readers of our newsletters, and we got the response basically that came out to something like 98.5% that said, no, we absolutely don't want to have cell phone calls. However, we then asked another question, and the question was, if you could choose to be on a flight with cell phone calls or without cell phone calls, what would you choose? And in that case, 65% of the people said that they would choose to not be on a flight with cell phone calls, and 35% said, oh, that they wouldn't mind being on a flight where they could choose to make cell phone calls. So when you ask the questions different ways, you end up with slightly different situations. And if we go back a little bit to the knee defender issue, it's not really the knee defender that was causing the problem. The problems are caused because we have an aviation system where they're trying to put as many people as possible into airplanes. They keep squeezing us close together. And I spoke with the CEO of one of the low-cost carriers, and they actually acknowledge that they're pushing the edges of this, that nobody can sit this close together for more than about 2 hours. And that's on airlines where they only have 28 inches of pitch. And so they know that that's a problem, and they know that it's leading to misconduct or air rage. And it's sort of like we're flying in an airborne petri dish here. It's a big test case.
Steve, the FCC says it would consider allowing passengers to use cellular service above 10,000 feet. How would the technology work? Could I just turn on my phone and use my Verizon service to call home from my seat?
Well, not using our technology. There's two technologies that you could use to deliver cell phone service in the air or make voice calls available to passengers in the air. One of them is what Aeromobile had referred to earlier, which is putting a Pico cell on the plane, which basically is like putting a mini cell tower on the plane that will allow the cellular connection. The other is what the way we do it today is we enable a service called Wi-Fi calling, and it's similar to what T-Mobile offers right now, which basically just allows you to use your phone just the way you would on the ground over the Wi-Fi network. And that's the technology we prefer to use, mainly because you really don't have to touch a plane that already has GoGo service on it to enable it. It's an application-based service. So as I mentioned before, the technology has existed for a while. It just requires somebody to download an application to do it. But again, to reiterate, there's just no market for it right now for voice calls. Now, we see a tremendous opportunity for text messaging, and our partnership with T-Mobile has been going very well, and the passengers who have discovered it are really in favor of the ability to send text messages.
Julie, when it comes to voice phone calls, in addition to the nuisance factor, what are the security concerns about enabling real-time air-to-ground phone calls during flights?
Well, certainly during situations where we have to have full passenger attention, we think that it could be certainly a distraction. It's difficult enough to have passengers pay attention to the safety and security messages that are brought on board, and in the event of an incident, we are the last line of defense to the cockpit, and we need to have full passengers' attention. So that's definitely a concern. I might add that in 2005, when this was last revisited, the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI also wrote position statements saying that they were opposed to that. With this most recent round of reconsideration, I haven't really heard from any of those agencies and what their position may be. So we think that this needs to be revisited and explored more thoroughly before any consideration take place allowing voice calls on board the aircraft.
Here is Tim in Fairfax, Virginia. Tim, your turn.
Hi. My comment is just that, you know, if it is deemed to be safe, I would expect that, you know, it's not something that federal regulators should really decide about. It should be up to the airlines and really up to the rules of social norms to decide what our behavior is. I mean, if people find it a nuisance, I would think that people generally wouldn't do it, actually. I mean, if you think of places where you do make phone calls in public places, I mean, you know, I don't tend to make one in public places because I think it's kind of rude to do so. So, I mean, I think people won't do it as much as people are thinking, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just have
a lot of people argue, like Tim does, that once the safety issues are resolved, the government should butt out, leave the decision to the individual airlines. But, Julie, you'd like to see a national policy banning voice calls while in the air. Why?
Well, because I think for the passenger experience, we know that It's frustrating right now, we hear, and I'm sure Charlie could speak to that, the inconsistency with the pricing mechanisms that are currently in place with the cafeteria style of pricing. And to the extent that we can provide a consistent experience for passengers that get on board the aircraft, it's going to be better not only for those cabin crew that are working the aircraft, but for the passengers themselves. We saw this with actually e-cigarettes for a short period of time. It was inconsistent, and the Department of Transportation stepped in and made a consistent policy that banned it. Everyday flight attendants deal with carry-on baggage. Once again, it's a very inconsistent policy. Passengers get on board and said, but I was able to do it on my last flight. Why can't I do it on this flight? So I think it's a disservice because people do not know what they're going to expect when they get on the aircraft. So for that reason, along with many others, we think there should be a consistent policy across aviation.
Charlie Leoka.
Well, I mean, I agree that we should have some sort of policy that would be consistent, but I really think that the Department of Transportation right now has more than enough on its plate. I don't, and after being in Washington now about 6 years working on these different issues, I'm not sure that the way to go would be with a DOT kind of policy. And I think that the airlines probably would be able to maintain control over this, and they'd be able to test it and see how things work, where cell phones use might be okay on business-type flights, might be okay just for short times. But it's something which we can play with and see what the public really wants.
Here now is Cheryl in Severna Park, Maryland. Cheryl, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I am a 38-year transatlantic flight attendant currently flying, and I agree with Julie that this is something that not, as a flight attendant, as a crew member, we think it would be a nightmare to handle. It's hard enough when the passengers cannot recline their seats and still lower their tray tables and have a nice meal. But the idea of people being able to talk on their cell phones, even on short flights, which if you're stuck on a runway, you could a two-hour flight could be a four-hour flight. It scares us, frankly.
Okay.
Think about this.
Thank you very much for your call, underscoring Julie Frederick's sentiment. We got an email from Joshua who says, if this is an addition network service that may or may not be provided by the airline, who absorbs the costs of providing it? Would the service increase the cost of flying? If so, will it be an optional add-on for those not intending to utilize the service? Do you know, Charlie Leoka?
Well, basically, the way that it's set up is that it would be an additional cost to the person using the service. And that's what would happen with it. The airlines could set their own price. There'll be a roaming charge, which, as I understand it, in discussions with the air mobile people, there's a roaming charge just like you were if you were in a foreign country. The little airplane becomes like a flying country, a little country. And then the airlines are allowed to add something on top of that if they wanted to. So it's going to become another profit center from the airlines' point of view.
If you've had experience with roaming charges, you know what to expect. What happens now, Julie? What's the timeline for a decision on this issue?
The sooner the better as far as we're concerned.
Charlie, do you know what the timeline for a decision?
No, they've come out with an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, but they have not come out with the final rulemaking yet, and then that will probably be put up for comment over a period of time. So if we expect anything, it will probably be in effect towards the end of next year.
And Steve Nolan, what are you expecting, that the market would determine this?
Yeah, I mean, we very much think that the market will determine it. And one point that I wanted to clarify is through a service like we would provide, there's many business models to it. You wouldn't have to pay roaming charges if it went through the Wi-Fi network like we do it now. But you also, the business model could run the gamut. The airlines could pay for it. We could pay for it and charge the passenger. Or in the case of like a T-Mobile, we could have a third party who would pay for it as well. So
Steve Nolan is Director of Communications for Gogo. Charles Leoka is Chairman and Founder of Travelers United. Julie Frederick is Government Affairs Representative for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants. She's an international flight attendant for American Airlines with over 30 years of flying experience. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, Obamacare Round 2. Federal and state health care exchanges open with fewer technical bumps but new political challenges. Then at 1, going beyond local, James Beard Award-winning chef Sean Brock is reviving regional southern dishes from the past. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.